Hey y'all, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
Well, how you doing, Lena?
I'm good.
You're enrobed.
Well, yeah, my Sherpa.
Entombed, if you will. Okay, so guys, Lena and I were just talking about our merch. Lena's over there wearing one of our t-shirts because she's number one fangirl.
Gotta represent.
Exactly. So, we are going to be closing our merch shop at the end of August, and we will give you a date closer to time, but get those orders in. And also, we wanted to just give you a little tip.
Right. So, things that we've discovered is that if you order one of the sparkly, what are they called?
Water bottles. Yeah.
Yeah, the sparkles kind of cover up the picture and kind of makes it fuzzy, so I wouldn't recommend one of those. And also the travel coffee mug leaks, and yeah, so I wouldn't recommend that.
There is nothing worse than a leaking coffee mug.
Yeah, I agree.
Every drop counts, so... So anyway, FYI about that. And anything else we need to discuss?
Actually, yeah. So I need to answer your question from last week
about the lottery.
Yeah, you had asked me if I won $1 million.
No, I said if you won the lottery. So
won the lottery. Okay.
Billions. Could be billions. Oh. Millions.
Yeah. Well, regardless, if I won a lot of money and had to give it away to one person, who would it be? The simple answer, if I could, would be my husband, because I know he would share it. But if that's not allowed, I would give it to a niece or nephew that I could trust to share it as well.
Which one, though?
That's the problem. I haven't figured out which one yet is trustworthy. So kids, if you're listening, be on your best behavior.
Be on your best behavior, because you could be inheriting millions of dollars. That's a good shout. Yes. Well, thank you for that.
So you ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. This case, if you've been listening to true crime stories for a while, you've probably heard this one. You know, we do like to talk about the lesser told stories, but this case has so much to it. It's one of those cases that, much like the other one I told a couple of weeks ago, the suspect is hiding in plain sight.
Oh.
So Sherry Rasmussen Rutten.
Oh.
Do you remember her?
I do.
She was a daughter of Nels and Loretta Rasmussen, and she had two sisters, Teresa and Connie, and Sherry was the middle child. She was very goal-oriented, even as a child, and she was very advanced and even skipped two grades in school.
Whoa.
She was known to be very kind and gentle and compassionate, hardworking, and caring. These are all characteristics of a great nurse, right?
Yes. So
she became a nurse at a very young age, and her best friend, actually, who was a nurse with her, explained how Sherry would get to know her patients and could probably tell you their life story when she was done with them.
Yeah.
She became a trainer or a teacher for nurses at the hospital that she worked at, kind of like a continuing education kind of thing. And so She was such an asset to her career and to the world around her. Her family said that she was the glue that held the family together.
Aww.
Kind of like the negotiator, if you will.
The mediator.
At the age of 29 years old, she was working as nursing director at the Glendale Adventist Hospital. She met John Rutten at a party, and they quickly fell in love. They married on November 23rd of 1985, and just a month later, they would be celebrating their first Christmas as a married couple. John was an engineer, and the two of them lived in a gated condo complex in the Van Nuys section of Los Angeles. And he had recently bought Sherry a silver BMW as a present.
Oh, that's a nice present.
Yeah. So 3 months after getting married, on February 24th of 1986, Sherry had stayed at home from work that day. She had injured her back doing aerobics.
Oh, I would.
Yeah, I feel you, girl. Like, I hurt my back just sneezing these days. But she was really close to her sister, Teresa, and they talked every day. And Teresa called Sherry's work that day around 10 a.m., as she did most days. This was her break time. And co-workers had told Teresa that Sherry did not come to work that day. And so she called Sherry at home, and Sherry did not answer. John came home from work and found Sherry lying on the living room floor. She was bloodied, beaten, and lifeless. She had numerous gunshot wounds to the chest, and from the looks of the scene, it was a burglary gone very wrong. I mean, that's how it looked, at least, to the Los Angeles police detectives who arrived on the scene.
Oh, LAPD.
Yeah. So when John had come home from work at 5:55, he had known instantly that something was wrong. The garage door was open, and Sherry's silver BMW was gone. It seemed strange that she would not be home. I mean, he knew that she called into work. She was still in bed when he left for work that morning. And so John rushed inside, and that's where he found his wife's body on the living room floor. The place had been ransacked. I mean, shards of broken porcelain vase, and a TV wall unit was partially collapsed. A credenza drawer had been pulled out, and its contents, which was mostly documents, was dumped on the floor. I mean, speakers and the stereo system were sitting on the floor, like, stacked up, ready to go. The lead homicide detective, Lyle Mayer, began to piece together what he thought had taken place. The assumption was that the burglars must have entered through the unlocked front door. Now, the layout of the condo, it's like a townhouse, like a narrow townhome, and you walk in, the first floor is the living room, the second floor is the kitchen dining area, and the third floor is where the bedrooms were.
Oh.
So Mayer's suggestion was that while one of the burglars removed the electronics from the wall unit, the other burglar went upstairs and was surprised by Sherry. Now, she was found wearing a robe, a t-shirt, and panties, which suggested to them that she had not been expecting visitors.
Right.
Sherry was 6 feet tall and fit.
Wow.
I mean, she was doing aerobics.
Yeah.
That's how she hurt her back. So by the looks of the scene, Sherry put up a tough fight. It evidently began in the dining room on the second floor. They found that shots were fired from a .38 caliber pistol in the dining room, and one of which may have hit Sherry at that point.
Oh.
A blood trail down the stairs and a bloody handprint near the front door suggested that Sherry had tried to escape or reached the panic button on the alarm panel.
Oh, wow.
But she was followed downstairs.
So they had an alarm system.
Yes. I mean, it was mentioned in this report, but nothing else was mentioned about the alarm system.
Wow. Okay.
When Sherry made it to the living room, she fought. During the fight, she had been bitten on her left forearm.
Oof.
Yeah, vicious. And this wasn't just teeth marks. The skin had been broken and blood was drawn to the surface.
Ouch.
I mean, that sounds personal, doesn't it?
My twins bite each other. Definitely personal.
Yeah. She was struck over the head with the heavy vase that was now broken on the floor. The assailant had then taken a quilt from across the room, presumably to muffle the gunshot, and fired more shots through it. The housekeeper in the unit next door later said that she heard a scuffle and a scream, but she never heard gunshots. She figured it was domestic or a domestic altercation, and she did not call the police.
That's wild, though, isn't it? Like, they're in townhomes. They're sharing walls with people. And
yeah.
She didn't hear gunshots?
I know. That's what I'm, like, you heard a scuffle, but not gunshots.
Wow.
Okay. I don't know. It's really odd to me. So, Sherry had been shot 3 times in the chest.
Mm.
The bullets pierced her heart, her lungs, and spine.
Oh.
And when the killer was done, they stole Sherry's purse and the BMW parked in the garage. Most items in the house appeared undisturbed, including Sherry's jewelry box, which was sitting in plain view on her dresser if they would have gone to the third floor. So if it had been a burglary, it seemed that the events had been rushed to a quick exit because, I mean, after gathering all of the electronics that were on the floor, and the only thing stolen were Sherry's purse and car. Like,
yeah,
you got it all prepared. Why didn't you take it?
Right.
So at about 2 o'clock the next morning, Lloyd Mahaney, a criminalist from the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office, arrived to examine the body. It was his second homicide of the night. He began by checking for trace evidence around the victim's body. Hairs, fibers, anything unusual, but he didn't find anything useful. Next, he opened a sexual assault kit and collected a series of swabs and slides, and this is when he noticed the bite mark on Sherry's arm. He carefully swabbed the impression left by the assailant's teeth.
Okay.
This swab was sealed, placed in an envelope, and put into evidence.
Good.
Yeah. Smart thinking.
Mm-hmm.
John was taken to the station and questioned, and he was distraught and just seemed really sad, like just cried. He actually was too upset and emotional to tell Sherry's parents what happened, so he had his dad call Sherry's parents.
I can't imagine having to tell somebody's parents that.
No, I know. Like, that doesn't seem abnormal to me to not be, like, your wife of 3 months, like, you don't want to call their parents and tell them that their daughter's dead. Like, he didn't protect her, you know?
And even just saying the words, Sherry's dead, you know, that's, no. I can't imagine.
Yeah. Sherry's parents asked to talk to John, but their request was denied. His dad just said, no, he's too emotional. John eventually took a polygraph, and it was labeled as inconclusive as he was too emotional to complete the exam. He did have an alibi. He was working that day.
Yeah.
So Sherry's sisters had even come to visit the weekend before the murder, and they stayed at the condo with Sherry and John. They made note how much John doted on Sherry, and they held hands, and they were just so lovey with each other.
Newlyweds.
Nels and Loretta, Sherry's parents, they arrived in Los Angeles from Arizona the day after the murder. Nels immediately talked to Mayer, the lead detective, who informed him that the police were looking for one or more burglars in the connection with the killing. He also assured that they ruled out John Rutten as a suspect. Nels told him that his daughter had complained 1 or 2 months earlier about John's ex-girlfriend.
Oh.
This ex-girlfriend showed up at the hospital where Sherry worked one day and confronted her. At one point, she had told Sherry, "If I can't have him, no one can."
Okay.
"And I will be here for John to pick up the pieces when y'all's marriage falls apart.
Thanks for letting me know."
Yeah. So Sherry also told Nels that a woman dressed like a boy had been following her. Yeah. Nels didn't know the ex-girlfriend's name, but he knew that she was a Los Angeles police officer.
Oh?
When Nels said that to the detective says, "Sir, I think you've been watching a little too much TV." What? Who says that?
LAPD.
To a grieving father. Lord. So in Nels' mind, this ex-girlfriend was the prime suspect. Mayer made a note of the ex-girlfriend in the case file, but apparently never followed up.
Oh, no.
The stolen BMW was found abandoned about a week later with the keys in it.
Okay.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to go into someone's home, you're going to take their stuff, kill the person, and then just dump what you took.
Yeah, exactly.
John spoke at Sherry's funeral and spoke so sweetly of Sherry and how proud he was of her. They showed a clip of it in a video that I watched, and it just, he seemed so heartfelt. 2 months after the murder, a pair of men attempted a robbery a few blocks from Sherry and John's condo. That also involved a gun. And so these burglars became the focus of this homicide investigation. Yeah. But the suspects had not been caught. Months passed without any further leads. In late October that year, the Los Angeles Times ran a story reporting that the Rasmussens were offering a $10,000 reward for any information regarding the suspects in their daughter's murder, whom detectives described in the article as two Latino men between 5 feet 4 inches and the other was 5 feet 6 inches tall. In 1986, the year Sherry was killed, Los Angeles recorded 831 murders.
Ay, ay, ay.
Another report I read, it said 834, but, you know, once you get up to that number, like, seems all the same. It's too many.
Too many.
By the end of the year, LAPD homicide detectives had solved 538 of those murders.
Jeez. That's... I mean, that's a lot. But also the just the workload that they would have had on their hands.
Oh yeah, it's
that leaves over 300 other families still waiting for answers.
Waiting. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, and it seemed that they were. I mean, to solve it within the year. I mean, I guess. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
I feel like is really good.
Yeah, that
to solve
is good.
That many.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's still a lot. Sherry's case was among the unsolved and would end up going cold.
Oh, no.
Years would actually go by. And so just 7 months after Sherry's murder, DNA was used in a criminal investigation for the first time in England.
Oh.
And 1990 would be the first year that Los Angeles would use DNA to get a conviction.
Nice.
Nels actually brought up this subject of DNA forensics to the detectives and offered to pay for DNA analysis of the evidence that they had on file at a private lab. The detective turned him down.
What?
He said that's just not a process that they allowed.
I'm sorry? Okay, is this the same guy that told him he was watching too much TV?
It probably was.
Girl. Gosh.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just something that they said that the department did not allow. So a lot would happen between then and 2003. A man named David Lampkin came along to the LAPD. He had been working with biological evidence for years and was already convinced of DNA's potential. Moreover, he believed strongly that the LAPD had a moral obligation to do its best to solve these cold cases.
Yeah.
Detective Lampkin was involved in several cases that had been solved with DNA. In 2001, LAPD officially started their cold case homicide unit with seven detectives involving David Lampkin.
Wow.
During the summer and fall of 2003, Lampkin's unit was working its way case by case, and 1,400 unsolved homicides by that time were flagged as having good forensic potential.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So on September 19th, DNA analysis was requested on evidence from the 1986 murder of Sherry Rasmussen. It wasn't until December of 2004 that the first article analyzed was a blood swatch taken at the autopsy that matched Sherry's DNA profile. The items initially tested were a piece of a fingernail found on the floor at the crime scene and a blood-stained towel. And that yielded only the victim's profile. Then criminalist Jennifer Francis noticed that the property sheet listed a bite mark swab.
Right.
Bells went off. She's like, ding, ding. I need to get this.
Yeah.
So she couldn't find this swab in the rape kit that or anywhere else in with the evidence. So they called around, asked around, we need to get this. And a week went by before the coroner's office could locate the missing evidence. But they did. They got it and sent it. So the 5x7-inch envelope that Lloyd Mahaney had sealed the swab in 1986 was now crumpled and worn. There was a tear on one end. The red-capped top of the tube holding the swab was sticking out of the envelope. But the tube itself appeared intact.
Okay.
And when Miss Francis analyzed the swab, it yielded a mixture of two DNA profiles. One of which was Sherry's. The other profile did not return a CODIS hit. So by that time, a lot of DNA was uploaded in the CODIS system. So this meant that the suspect was not in the FBI's DNA database. But Mrs. Francis noticed the gender marker on the results. In most violent crimes, the suspect comes up XY for male. But the DNA results were XX, meaning that the person who bit Sherry was female.
Bum, bum, bum.
Now, Miss Francis had little information about the case or possible suspects, but she typed up her conclusions and sent the report to the cold case unit on February 8th of 2005. So this whole thing had taken over a year to process. But a few months before, California voters had approved Proposition 69. This required police to collect DNA samples from all individuals arrested for a felony or a sex crime, or as well as from the state prison inmates who had been convicted of such crimes. The DNA profiles of tens of thousands of California inmates were uploaded to the FBI database. So for them not to get a match with all these in the database, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's wild.
Yeah. In 2005, Lampkin's unit was swamped with CODIS-based cold hits, DNA reports implicating suspects previously unknown to detectives. And so they were able to solve a lot of cold cases. So they had this clue that a woman might be Sherry's murderer. However, it did not point directly to a specific suspect. Miss Francis's report went into Sherry's case file, and the case file went back on the shelf where it would sit for a couple more years.
Aye, aye, aye.
David Lampkin had retired in 2007, and by that time, the cold case homicide unit had solved over 40 cold cases, and Robert Bubb, another veteran homicide detective, took over Lampkin's spot. So due to all the changes with the unit, Sherry's case file was returned back to where it came from, to the Van Nuys division. But in March of 2008, Bubb accepted a transfer to the Van Nuys homicide unit. The detectives in the department now consisted of Pete Barba, Mark Martinez, and Jim Nuttall. So in early February 2009, Detectives Nuttall and Barba began seeking out cold cases to work on. They started working on Sherry Rasmussen's case. Her case caught Nuttall's attention because of how hard she fought for her life. Like, he's like, I've got to work for this lady.
Right, exactly.
He just felt that this was not a robbery like the original investigators came up with. Mm-hmm. Detective Nuttall said, it was four books when it reached him, four books deep.
Wow.
He said they kept a pretty good record of everything that was done over the past 23 years.
Wow.
When Nuttall reached the 2005 DNA analysis report, he saw immediately that the gender marker was incompatible with the original theory of the case. He said, that jumps off the page at you, because when you have that and you're aware that the case was based on two male burglars, well, that alters the entire course of the investigation. And he says you have to go back to square one.
Oof.
So that's what he did. The detectives went back over the whole investigation, but this time with the assumption that they were looking for a female suspect. When they finished going through the case file, they had a list of five female names. One of those names was Stephanie Lazarus. Who was Stephanie Lazarus? Well, she is John Rutten's ex-girlfriend.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Next to her name in one of the old notes were the initials P.O. When the detective called John Rutten, he told him that Stephanie had been a Los Angeles police officer. They did have a kind of more than friends relationship, but he really wasn't into her and she wanted more from him.
While he was married?
Not while he was married. So when he met Sherry, he says he broke off the friendship or relationship with Stephanie.
She just never got over it?
No, she was obsessed with him. She wasn't having it. So Detective Nuttall was stunned at the thought that a cop might have killed someone and got away with it. It was extremely difficult initially to process that possibility, he said. The detectives typed her name into the LAPD's directory, and there she was, Detective Stephanie Lazarus. The detectives made two pacts regarding Sherry's case. First, they agreed that they would maintain total secrecy and would never speak or write Stephanie Lazarus's name where anyone else might hear it or see it.
Wow.
Smart guys. Her code name on all of the paperwork was number 5, as she was the fifth woman on the possible suspect list. There was no way to know who in the division might be acquainted with her, and they didn't want to dirty her name in the event that she didn't have anything to do right. with the murder. So they also didn't want to tip her off in the event that she did do something and, you know, everything go.
Yeah, because I can imagine she had access to the information, like, about the investigation and all those years going by and being like, oh, it's cold. Oh, they're working on it. Oh, they didn't find anything. Oh,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Or even if she wasn't paying attention to it, maybe one day she'd be like, oh, I wonder what's going on with that exactly. and look into yeah. it. Yeah. So the second thing that they promised each other was that they would follow the trail of evidence wherever it led. They knew that this was not a random act of violence. So they were going to get to the bottom of this, no matter if it was an LAPD officer. They didn't care. They wanted answers. So the Van Nuys detectives quickly eliminated 3 of the 5 women on their list for having insufficient motive to harm Sherry. Those 3 women were, I think it was her mom, her sister, and her best friend. I guess, you know, you want to go for the closest females to her.
Yeah.
Who was number four? Do what?
Who was number 4?
So number 4 was a nurse that worked with Sherry, and they argued and they, yikes. Well, this nurse tried to argue with Sherry. Like, Sherry didn't, she was very pleasant. Like, she didn't yeah. want to, she was matter of fact, and this other nurse did not like it. She butted heads with Sherry because Sherry wouldn't let her get her way. But she was quickly ruled out.
Can you imagine being that woman and being like, oh, I was on the suspect list? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. They were able to get her DNA and ruled her out through that. Oh, good. So, yeah. So now we're left with number 5.
Oh, number 5.
So what detectives would come to find out was that Stephanie and John became close friends at UCLA, where they had lived in the same dorm. They were dorm mates.
Oh.
After graduating in the early 1980s, they dated on and off. And as I told you earlier, John says he wasn't that into her, more like friends with benefits kind of thing. In 1985, John began dating Sherry, and it became serious. He proposed to her that summer, and they married in November.
Wow.
This sent Stephanie in a spiral fit of rage. And 3 months later, Sherry would be dead. Mm. In 1986, at the time of the murder, Stephanie was 26 and in her 3rd year as a patrol officer with the LAPD. In 1993, she made detective, and in 1996, she married a fellow LAPD officer and later adopted a little girl. She's just living her life, y'all.
Yeah.
In her long career, she had never been involved in a use of force incident or been accused of any misconduct. Like, she was minding her P's and Q's.
Wow.
Detective Mark Martinez recalled that in the mid-1980s, most LAPD cops carried a .38 as their backup or off-duty gun. And if you'll remember, this is the same caliber weapon indicated on the ballistics.
She should know, as a cop, using your own gun? Like,
yeah.
Maybe it escalated. Maybe she didn't mean, like, she didn't go there to use her gun. She just was going to be killed if she didn't use her gun, because Sherry was going to tear her up.
So that's one thing that they, one story that her friend... Her best friend lived with her. I'll get into that in a minute. But her friend thought, well, maybe Stephanie came into the house and didn't expect anybody to be home. And Sherry came downstairs to go feed the cat or something in her robe. And that's when she caught Stephanie there, and it just escalated. Mm. Yeah. So on April 30th, the detectives entered Stephanie's name into the California State Gun Registry. which returned a list of all of the firearms that she had ever registered, and one of them was a .38, and it had been reported stolen on March 9th of 1986.
Wow, how convenient.
That was 13 days after the murder. So looking at a copy of the stolen gun report, they see that Stephanie told the Santa Monica Police Department that her car, which was parked near Santa Monica Pier, had been broken into. She said that the lock on the driver's side door had been punched, and a blue gym bag was stolen. The contents of the stolen bag were clothes, half a dozen cassette tapes, and the handgun, which she described as a Smith & Wesson 5-shot .38 revolver. Detectives Nuttall called Nels, Sherry's father, and asked him to walk him through everything from A to Z. After all these years, Nels had a great memory. He had done his best to do his own investigation. Yeah. He recounted everything. The detective told Nels, "Give me time to do what I have to do, and I think I'll be able to have answers for you."
Wow.
The next step was to obtain a sample of Stephanie's DNA to compare the bite mark swab. They talked about obtaining it in a secret manner, but there would have been too many variables involved and too much potential for screw up. And they knew that they had to do everything. They had to get it done precisely and correctly in order to move forward and resolve the case. So before they went around secretly, they went to, Bub went to his lieutenant and briefed him on the investigation. The captain and the chief of the Valley Bureau were quickly brought in to the loop. Bub said that they explained this could still turn out not to be her, and that this at this point there were some coincidences, but there was nothing definitive. The chief allowed the case to go forward, and they decided to surreptitiously obtain the DNA. So on May 27th of 2009, after a week of preparation and surveillance, detectives in plain clothes followed Stephanie as she ran errands, going into Costco, ordering a drink. When she threw out the cup and straw that she had been drinking from, the surveillance team swooped in and retrieved it from the trash.
I love this kind of stuff. I wish, like, departments would hire me to get, like, abandoned property, you know, for DNA samples. That would be so much fun. Because who would, like, suspect a woman walking by the trash? That's way more inconspicuous than, like, a man getting out of an unmarked car and going to the trash. You know what I mean? It's like,
Oh,
I would love to do that. Yeah. We should start a company. Okay,
I know. Carry on. No, side note, I've been watching that Adventures with a Purpose. They go do the sonar channel in the lakes.
Yes.
It's so inspiring. Like, it I want to really go help is. These people.
I know.
Okay, back to the story. A DNA profile was quickly developed from the saliva on the straw and compared with the unidentified profile extracted from the bite mark swab. On May 29th, detectives got a call from the lab saying, "Yes, it's a match."
Yikes, as Granddad would say.
The case would now be transferred to the robbery homicide division. Two detectives, Greg Stearns and Dan Jaramillo, sorry, I'm not Hispanic, I'm not Spanish, I can't say it, they both were assigned to the case, and Stephanie was, she was friendly with several of the RHD. These two were selected in part because they did not know Stephanie well, and they had no bias for or against her, so.
That's a good strategy.
Yeah. Within hours of receiving the DNA results, Bub and Nuttall were giving the rundown and details of the case. When they finished, all four detectives went straight from RHD to the DA's office, where Bub and Nuttall briefed the prosecutors who would be handling the case.
Oh, Man, I've got chills. I've heard this story before, but like this part is where you get chills because you're like, oh my gosh, here it comes.
You're seeing all the steps, all the hard work. Yes,
all the hard work and the decades that have gone by.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Sherry's family was made aware of what was going on with the case, but they didn't quite tell them that an arrest was about to be made. So the big decision was how to confront Stephanie. Chief Bratton didn't want anybody approaching her when she had a gun or access to a gun. In the end, they decided to stage the interview at Parker Center's jail division, located on the floor directly below the robbery homicide division and the art theft detail where she worked. Firearms were not allowed in the jail, so it would not seem unnatural for her to have to surrender her gun before entering. The plan was for the RHD detectives to request Stephanie's help interviewing a jailed suspect who claimed to have information on an art theft case. When she arrived at the interrogation room, they would shift gears and gradually turn to the Rasmussen case. So this was all their plan. Stearns and Jaramillo's goal would be to keep her talking as long as possible while simultaneously assuring her that she was free to leave at any time. They planned that the moment that she ended the interview and walked out of the room, she would be arrested, regardless of what she had told them. The interview was scheduled for early in the workday on Friday, June 5th, and so Chief Bratton wanted the Rasmussen family informed of the arrest in person as soon as it happened, so they didn't hear all about it from the media.
Yeah.
Detective Nuttall called the Rasmussens and he said he was coming back and he would need to see them again on Friday morning. Well, Nels replied that he had a doctor's appointment. And Nuttall said, Nels, if you can reschedule it, you may want to reschedule it. So at 6:40, bright and early in the morning, on June 5th, 2009, Detective Jaramillo stopped by Stephanie Lazarus's desk. He was wearing a wire, and he said, Stephanie, do you know me? I'm Dan Jaramillo. I work here on the other side, and he explained that he was working on a case that had a suspect in jail, was talking about stolen art. I don't know a lot about this stuff. Can you help me talk to him? Can you see if he's for real? And she's, sure. When they got into the interrogation room, Stearns and Jaramillo flipped the script and explained to her that her name came up in a case involving an ex-boyfriend of hers, John Rutten. They told her they knew that she was married to someone else and they selected this place where they could talk privately away from gossiping colleagues. The interview lasted for more than an hour. At first, it seemed unclear to her whether they were speaking with her as a possible witness or a criminal suspect. So in the interview, Detective Jaramillo, he says, do you know John Rutten? And she says, Rutten? You mean Rutten? I know John Rutten. Like, okay, smart aleck. Detective Jaramillo says, was there any relationship or anything that developed between you and him? And she says, yeah, I mean, we dated. What's this all about? And Stern says, have you ever met his wife? She says, I may have. Stern says, do you remember her name or anything or what she did for a living or where she worked or anything about her? And Stephanie says, well, I think she was a nurse. I thought you brought me here to talk about an art case. I don't understand why you're talking to me about some guy I dated a million years ago. And Detective Stern says, well, do you know what happened to his wife? And Stephanie says, yeah, she got killed.
Okay.
And Stern says, and you said you thought his wife was a nurse. Do you have any idea where she was working at the time? Or did he ever mention that to you? Was it a hospital or a doctor's office? And she says, I'm sure he must have mentioned it. I mean, Now that you bring it up, I think she worked at a hospital somewhere. And yeah, I may have met her at the hospital. I may have talked to her once or twice. Detective Jaramillo says, do you know what circumstances were regarding her death? And she says, geez, let me think back. Geez, I don't know. It was a burglary or something. Yeah, it's been so many years. And Jaramillo says, do you remember her first name? And Stephanie says, Shelly, Sherry.
Oh, come on.
You know. I don't know.
You probably have it tattooed on your butt cheek.
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine? So Stephanie says, now that you guys are bringing all this stuff up, I mean, that sounds familiar. And stuttering over her words, she says, but again, you know, what's this got to do with me dating him and, you know, her getting killed? I mean, I don't have anything to do with it. And Jaramillo says, I know you went to talk to her at the hospital regarding this issue with John, but would you ever have followed up to her house where you went to talk to her? And she says, I don't even know that I knew where they lived. And Stern says, but you didn't have any issues with her, right? And she says, no. I mean, you know, obviously, if he was dating me and dating her, I probably said, hey, pick or something.
Okay.
So Jaramillo says, tell me about this. The car getting broken into. And she says, oh, yeah. Well, my car had been broken into several times. Jaramillo says, oh, really? Did you lose anything? And she says, yeah, now that you mention it, let's see. I had a gun that was stolen. And Stern says, did you have a fight with her? And Stephanie says, you mean like we fought? And Stern says, yeah, did you ever duke it out with her? And she says, this is where she realizes that she's the number one suspect. Mm-hmm. And she's like, this is insane. She says, I wish I would have been recording this because now it sounds like you're telling me these people say I'm fighting with her. And now it sounds like you're trying to, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. Okay. And now it almost sounds like you're trying to pin something on me.
Don't worry. They're recording it.
Yeah. So she was not able to provide an alibi for that day. For the murder. She was off work that day.
Oh.
Jaramillo asked her if she had been willing, or if she'd be willing to give them a DNA swab, and noted it's possible that we may have some DNA at the location, even though they already had her DNA. And that's when she wanted to contact a lawyer. She stopped talking. She's just, I'm shocked. And she stood and walked out. She got only as far as the jail's hallway, where she was stopped by other RHD detectives and placed in handcuffs. Got her. So Stephanie was taken to Linwood, the Los Angeles County Jail facility for female prisoners, where she was held on a $10 million wow. bond and charged with the murder of Sherry Rasmussen. Stephanie Lazarus's murder trial began in early 2012. Prosecutors believed her motive for the murder was jealousy over Sherry's relationship with her ex-boyfriend. The prosecutor, deputy, district attorney Shannon Presby stated, a bite, a bullet, a gun barrel, and a broken heart. That's the evidence that will prove to you that defendant Stephanie Lazarus murdered Sherry Rasmussen. Well, Stephanie's attorney, Mark Overland, argued that the investigation into Sherry's death was botched from the beginning, and the evidence collected did not point to Stephanie as Sherry's killer. Oh, come on.
No?
I mean, he's got to say something, but yeah. Come on. However, a 600-page journal that Stephanie wrote, that she wrote in, was brought to light at the trial, and it told of a story of how fixated and obsessed she was of John.
Whoa.
She talked about how depressed she was when he got married, and she even had a picture of John sleeping in his underwear with a caption that said, I snuck into his room at 1 a.m. to take this picture.
Okay. Creep.
Yeah. On March 8th of 2012, Stephanie was convicted of the murder in the first degree, and she was sentenced to 27 years to life in prison. She will be eligible for parole in 2039. So, yeah, all of that rage, and she didn't even get the relationship that she wanted with John. And actually, I heard that 2 years after the murder, John and Stephanie went to Hawaii together.
No.
Yeah, but he, like, several interviews with John, like, he really couldn't believe that Sherry could be, like, he, in some interviews, he's like, do y'all really think she did it? Like, she's a good person. He really seems naive about the whole thing.
Yikes.
Yeah. I don't know how you could be, like, you could viciously murder someone and live life, moving up in the ranks.
Oh,
like it never happened.
That is another level of evil. It's inconceivable. Yeah. Like, there are evil people that they're just evil and you know it. But someone who could literally walk around in a sheep suit.
Yeah, exactly. With no guilty conscience. Like, wow. That's a,
that's another level.
Yeah. But that's Sherry's story. So rest in peace, Sherry.
Rest in peace, you angel. Well, thanks for that, Lena. That was great. Let's do it again sometime.
All right. Let's do it.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye now.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.